Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, and a very warm welcome indeed to the 2017 University of Edinburgh Gifford Lectures. My name is Alvin Jackson. I am Richard Lodge Professor of History here at Edinburgh and a member of the University's Gifford Committee. I'm delighted to welcome back our distinguished speaker, Professor Stoudt, who is, of course, Professor of Religion at Princeton University and is continuing his series on the theme Religion Unbound, Ideals and Powers from Cicero to King. Now, those who were attending last week know that the lecture and question time of these lectures are recorded, and the video will be shortly available online for this evening on the University's Gifford Lectures web pages. And again, those of you who've been watching the site will know that the lectures from last week are already available on those pages. Now, there was a bit of interference, I think, with the sound system last week at one point. So in the light of that, can I ask that all unnecessary wireless devices are switched off or put on flight safe mode during this lecture, please? And this evening, Professor Stoudt is delivering his fourth lecture, which is entitled, as you can see from the overhead, Abolitionism, Political Religion, and Secularism. And I now have great pleasure indeed in handing you over to Professor Stoudt.
Thank you, Professor Jackson. Today, I hope to shed light on a split between two modes of emancipatory politics. The first distinguishes virtuous religion from its oppressive semblances, and the second declares religion essentially oppressive. This basic conceptual difference correlates with differences in argument, explanation, objectives, means, and organization. Differences that need to be clarified if we want to understand the political choices we are confronting today. Hume's British contemporaries, who reasserted religion's public importance as a moral virtue, included many Quakers, Anglicans, such as Thomas Clarkson, William Wilberforce, and Edmund Burke, Methodist John Wesley, Presbyterian James Beattie, and Unitarian Joseph Priestley. These men differed over the nature of rationality, the relation of religion to faith, of faith to reason, the divinity of Christ, and the relation of the church to magistrate. But they spoke with one voice, the ones I have just mentioned, on true religion's incompatibility with slavery. Their distinction between religion's supernatural and mundane ends permitted them to cooperate. The religiously plural nature of their coalition was essential to its political successes. Philadelphian Ralph Sandiford was, as far as I can determine, the first Quaker to challenge the scriptural basis for taking Africans to be bearers of the curse of Cain described in Genesis. Using terms that should now be familiar to those who've attended the previous lectures, Sandiford wrote that what he had learned of, quote, the eternal love of the Father and of Christ's redemptive suffering would not, quote, allow his followers to take part in the most arbitrary and tyrannical oppression that hell has invented on this globe. So oppression and tyranny remain the vocabulary we've been watching this develop. Shortly after Benjamin Franklin published these words in 1729, Sandiford withdrew from the Philadelphia Quaker meeting, whose members then formally expelled him. So he first withdrew, they then expelled him and shamed him into isolation, and he died soon thereafter. Sandiford's friend, Benjamin Lay, used street theater to dramatize both the condition of the slaves and the complicity of Northern consumers in oppression. I can reenact his street theater for you want during the Q&A. The Philadelphia Quakers took a public stand against slavery in 1754. Understanding that Quakers would generate little power on their own, Anthony Benezet did extensive networking outside his own community and across the Atlantic. His most notable convert was Benjamin Franklin, a former slaveholder and later the honorary chair of an anti-slavery society founded by Benezet. The printer James Phillips and his Quaker friends in London followed Benezet's organizational lead. They were overjoyed to recruit Thomas Clarkson. The reason they were overjoyed, in part, was because Anglicans held positions of power in England, and Clarkson was an Anglican. Clarkson became the movement's chief investigator and organizer in Britain. With Benezet, with Bennett Langton's help, Clarkson recruited Wilberforce, a well-connected member of Parliament who made his first speech for abolition in 1789 and proposed many relevant pieces of legislation thereafter. Wilberforce joined forces with Burke and Pitt, and this is how the leadership of a religiously plural international movement can emerge out of a single congregation's internal organizing. So we start with the Philadelphia Quaker meeting. We start with the act of one brave, isolated person. A friend of his then expands things. Another one, Benezet, becomes one of the first great modern organizers, and then Clarkson becomes the greatest of the organizers of this period. One bill proposed by Wilberforce came before Parliament in 1792, and in the months beforehand, Clarkson personally canvassed many cities in England. When faced with death threats, he took on a bodyguard. He and his associates appointed a young Quaker named William Dixon to canvass Scotland. Dixon's diary describes a mass meeting in Edinburgh conducted in virtual silence. As a result of that meeting, 4,000 people signed a petition that Dixon sent to London by coach. When unrolled in the House of Commons, the scrolls went from one end of the room to the other. Altogether, in a few weeks, 519 abolition petitions came in from England, Scotland, and Wales, bearing at least 390,000 names. Those are remarkable numbers for that period, given the population. When abolitionists repeated Adam Smith's argument against slavery's fiscal practicality, they were careful to add that this was not the consideration that motivated them. They were aware that philosophers skeptical about true religion's public role, including Hume and Voltaire, had asserted the natural inferiority of Africans to whites. James Beattie's 1771 critique of Hume's racist paternalism closely resembles Las Casas's critique of the Renaissance humanist Sepúlveda more than two centuries earlier. With Benezet and Clarkson, Beatty adduced facts against the claim that slavery was good for the slaves and against the claim of natural inferiority. So some of the arguments were straightforwardly factual. Slaves such as Equiano and later Frederick Douglass provided testimonial evidence of slavery's evil, but were also living examples of African virtue, intelligence, and eloquence. Donald Trump recently referred to Douglass as someone who has done an amazing job. Sort of half right, you know? A stop clock, said Chesterton, is right twice a day. That's before the digital age, however. Okay. Opposition to slavery, the abolitionists said, is a sacred duty. Christian charity requires benevolence toward everyone created in God's image. The slave's life is hardly bettered by capture, confinement, cruelty, or subjection. Africa, added Wilberforce, is grievously harmed, not bettered, by the slave trade. Slavery violates the golden rule. As Abraham Lincoln later put the point, for a supposedly good thing, quote, slavery is strikingly peculiar in this, that it is the only good thing which no man ever seeks the good of for himself. Slavery also violates liberty. The Bible, as well as ancient Athens and Rome, treat slavery as the paradigm of oppression, but without expressly prohibiting it. The abolitionists found this omission puzzling. How can the paradigm of oppression not be prohibited? St. Paul doesn't say, but that can perhaps be explained by the marginality of the early Christians in imperial politics. More worrisome was the thought that the Athenians and Romans, who had most eloquently lauded the value of freedom, took for granted that there could be no free men without reliance on slave labor. The abolitionists dismissed Aristotle's argument for enslaving barbarians as special pleading. How could Cicero have lamented the Roman Senate's loss of liberty under a dictator, while accepting the Republic's subordination of slaves, and how could he also resist land reform? British officials and the American founders were taking excessive comfort from flawed precedents. Give me liberty or give me death, said Patrick Henry to his fellow slaveholders in the Virginia House of Burgesses. If the trouble with being subjected to Pharaoh, Caesar, Hannibal, or George III is being subjected to arbitrary power, then what justifies slavery? Clarkson won a prize at Cambridge for a paper that raised such questions about slavery. It was that paper that drew him to the attention of the Quakers, who then persuaded him to expand it into a book. The epigraph, not accidentally, is a line from Livy, "Nor would I raise myself up by pressing another down." Beatty leads up to his critique of slavery in Elements of Moral Science by expounding a Ciceronian conception of freedom. His point is that this must be applied consistently without making exceptions on one's own behalf. Wilberforce's writings on religion reveal him to be an admirer of Milton. There's a Milton epigraph in one of his books. These were not followers of Hobbes. They raised the stakes of politics by speaking of calamity, tyranny, and oppression, the same rhetoric of the sublime we found in Las Casas. They demanded security from domination, and they demanded it for everyone. When visiting one plantation in the American South, Harriet Martineau came across a slave who had lost both legs in his third attempt to escape. He told her that his master was kind. An onlooker asked Martineau, quote, "What could make the ungrateful wretch run away three times from such a master?" Martineau responded, "He wanted to be free." "Free from such a master?" said the woman. "Free from any master," replied Martineau. Slavery is not merely cruel and malevolent. Regardless how cushioned the yoke, it leaves the slave at someone else's mercy. The relationship itself is ill-structured. Sandiford, Clarkson, and Wilberforce discussed false religion, what they called false religion, in order to undermine its role in legitimizing and maintaining slavery. Article 3 of David Walker's 1829 Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World makes the case with sublime vehemence and then asks the white American preacher, quote, "Of what kind can your religion be?" For Walker, a religion preaching racial distinction while claiming to be truly Christian and in a truly Republican country was doubly absurd. It's interesting that Walker's appeal is Republican in its vocabulary as well as Christian. Sometimes he attacked pro-slavery theology by adducing scriptural evidence against it, thus appealing to an authority recognized by his Christian opponents. This is arguing on a common basis, albeit from different perspectives on how the authoritative texts should be read. But Walker also sought to expose incoherence in pro-slavery commitments that he did not share. In Lecture 2, I called this practice immanent criticism and noted its connection with diagnosis of error. Immanent criticism proceeds as Socrates does in the Dialogues of Plato. It begins on the opponent's ground, supposing for the purposes of argument that their expressed or implied commitments are true. It then elicits from those commitments an implication that opponents would find troubling or absurd. Just as Socratic interrogation of Euthyphro gives a reader grounds for suspecting that Euthyphro, the Platonic character, is morally and intellectually corrupted, abolitionist immanent criticism often induces a similar suspicion of pro-slavery apologists. When the grounds for suspicion are made explicit, logical critique shifts toward ethical diagnosis. Defenders of slavery typically benefit from it somehow, as exploiters of slaves, as consumers of cheap sugar, as people who value acceptance from their peers, and as people who would be inconvenienced by change or the struggle to produce it. It is right to suspect that the benefit affects which beliefs are viewed as acceptable or as too obvious to need scrutiny or defense. In a famous court case, Cicero asked who benefited from the crime that had been committed. Cicero's client had not benefited, but someone else had. A self-interested motive would explain both the crime and the testimony of someone seeking to escape punishment. Testimony that serves the interest of the one giving it merits suspicion. Who then benefits from enunciating or believing or tolerating a theology that legitimizes slavery? Lincoln raised this question in a note on a book called Slavery Ordained by God by a man named F.A. Ross. The pro-slavery theologian, Lincoln argued, is nearly always someone who, if he decided that God wills the slave's freedom, would immediately need to, quote, walk out of the shade, throw off his gloves, and delve for his own bread. Will such a person, Lincoln asked, quote, be actuated by that perfect impartiality which has ever been considered the most favorable to correct decisions? Lincoln did not imply that religion is always in league with domination. He was not debunking all religion as marred by cognitive or moral distortion. He was saying that religion is no less susceptible to corruption by self-interest than testimony in a court of law. Murderers have an interest in giving false testimony. Beneficiaries of slavery have an interest in portraying slavery as acceptable. Is Lincoln suggesting that Dr. Ross first decided that enslaving blacks must somehow be defended and then constructed a pro-slavery theology in order to perform that political function? 17th century Republicans had charged monarchist prelates with priestcraft, a term of abuse I think invented by Harrington. Prelates dependent on government stipends were said to have an interest in devising a theology friendly to established power. As Milton wrote in Iconoclastes, quote, the deepest policy of a tyrant hath ever been to counterfeit religious. And we've seen that Machiavelli makes a similar point in the discourses on Livy's History of Rome when he speaks of religion conducted in the mode of the powerful. But Lincoln did not accuse Dr. Ross of priestcraft. Perceived self-interest need not enter the process of belief formation in a conscious or intentional way at all. We don't need to know how self-interest corrupts the process to have grounds for suspecting that it does. The moral and cognitive distortion of the commitments expressed and inculcated by religious practices, including politically consequential preaching and scholarship, can operate at a level below the conscious awareness of the persons caught up in it. The moral psychologies of Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, and Augustine all make ample room for this possibility. One does not need instruction from Marx, Nietzsche, or Freud to see this. Egalitarian freedom movements have generalized the who benefits suspicion as follows. Any belief or practice assisting in a paternalist justification of a relationship that leaves one person or group at the mercy of another needs to pass a simple test. For any such belief or practice, we can ask, who benefits if it is accepted? If the benefit accrues mainly to the paternalist, the one making the paternalistic justification for the hierarchy, then it is reasonable to suspect that the belief or practice has entered circulation and acquired the respect it has as a result of a cognitively, ethically distorted social or psychological process. The presumption of innocent belief formation that we normally bring to the interpretation of our fellow human beings is weakened. Now notice that in the parent-child hierarchy, the occupant of the lower-ranking role often does benefit from the power imbalance. What the paternalist is doing, as I discussed in an earlier lecture, is taking that case for granted and then trying to build analogies and to see whether the justification can work on the basis of a paternalist analogy. Well, in slavery, patriarchy, imperialism, racial segregation, and globalized capitalism, the benefits supposedly trickling down to the weaker party are meager and vastly offset. Now, things get more complicated, of course, when occupants of the lower rank themselves come to accept a paternalist view of their own status and capacities. Religion often plays a role in bringing that acceptance about. Sometimes this happens intentionally, but often not. The result is slavish dependency, a topic taken up in Genesis, Tacitus, Winstanley, Milton, Emerson, Nietzsche, and Malcolm X. Now, I'm going to return to this topic tomorrow and then again on Thursday under the heading of servility or slavishness. Socratic and Ciceronian questioning leads directly to a Livian explanation of the grip that false religion gets on people and the tendency of bad religion to make a bad political situation worse. Avarice, a lust for domination, sloth, and pride give rise to a corrupt character, which gives rise to tyranny and oppression, which gives rise to conscious or unconscious attempts to legitimize injustice or to cognitive irresponsibility on the part of those making arguments or on the part of those taking them up. These things can then further corrupt the people caught up in them. A Livian explanation of this sort is given from a value-committed standpoint. The explanation posits a qualitative distinction between the standpoint of the explainer and the corrupted perspective being explained. Even when observing parliamentary decorum, Wilberforce could not resist suggesting that the evil of slavery had corrupted the minds as well as hardened the hearts of its beneficiaries. The invention, acceptance, and perpetuation of pro-slavery theology are explained here as effects of moral corruption. And remember, religion for this tradition is still classified as a moral virtue, its deficiencies as moral vices. Avarice, a lust for domination, disproportionate self-love, sloth, and pride seek to justify themselves, and the resulting justificatory arguments are accepted in part because the beneficiaries of slavery want to think well of themselves. A failure to see or admit the truth is rooted in an unconscious desire to continue receiving the perceived benefits of slavery, and to do so with an untroubled conscience. Clarkson's essay on slavery expresses a worry about oppression's bad effects on evangelism. The worry parallels a concern we have already heard from Las Casas. Now, there's no reference to Las Casas in Clarkson's essay, but there is one in Clarkson's History of the Abolition of the African Slave Trade. I don't want to put too much on this point, but Christian slave traders, according to Clarkson, represent their religion as a system of robbery and oppression. They don't intend to do so, but that's the message picked up by the prospective converts. This thereby undermines not only their own propagation of the gospel, but also the future efforts by other Christians to win converts to the faith. Slavery, as Clarkson puts it, and these could have been Las Casas' words, quote, places insuperable impediments to a conversion. Elizabeth Hayrick is a powerful analyst of ordinary complicity in slavery, and if I can do anything to the historical reception of the abolitionist movement, it would be to elevate the significance of Elizabeth Hayrick. Add her to the syllabi, please. She defends, quote, the sacrifices involved in boycotting sugar, and she's a major proponent of boycotting sugar well before others are, and a severe critic of gradualism on the issue of abolition. But she refers to, quote, the irresistible argument of consistent example, another theme running through the entire lecture series I'm offering. The irresistible argument of consistent example. Like Las Casas, she integrates rhetorical and ethical reasons for exemplary sacrifice. To stand for freedom persuasively before others, your life must exemplify the ideal being preached. If you fail to renounce slavery's benefits, others will harbor the who benefits suspicion about you. In a speech delivered in Concord, New Hampshire on 11 February 1844, Frederick Douglass demanded from his white audience an answer to the question of why he remained a slave. He was initially introduced as a former slave. He corrects the introducer. I'm a fugitive slave. I'm a slave now, he says. And his answer to the question why he remained a slave was the religion which sanctifies the system under which I suffer. He added, your religion justifies our tyrants, and you are yourselves our enslavers. Of course, he's addressing an audience that has turned out for an abolitionist speech. Douglass spelled out his critique of Christianity in chapters 9 and 10 of his autobiographical narrative. In the appendix, he cautioned readers unfamiliar with his religious views against assuming him to be, quote, an opponent of all religion. What I have said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land, and with no possible reference to Christianity proper, for between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. Well, I have no reason to suspect the sincerity of Douglass's profession of true religion, yet he must have been aware that opposing all religion would have undercut the rhetorical effectiveness of his speech from the start. He's talking about the correction of faults and the way Christians do. Now let's say a little more about Lincoln. He was the most prominent American politician to oppose slavery, but for most of his life he stopped short of overt abolitionism. So as we classify the positions, he was anti-slavery but not abolitionist. A number of considerations kept him from taking a stronger stand. One could not seek national office without swearing to uphold the Constitution, which explicitly permitted slavery. If slavery were to be banned, the Constitution would have to be amended, yet the only available paths to amending it risked causing massive carnage and a severing of the Union. These were some of his concerns. That Lincoln had the tradition of Cicero and Milton in view when deciding how to move forward is evident from his decision to name his new party Republican. Because classical Republicans considered being enslaved a horrible fate, yet did not oppose slavery as such, Lincoln regarded them as shamefully inconsistent. The American founders were guilty of the same hypocrisy, and his way of resolving this contradiction was to become what he called a democratic Republican. In a notebook entry of 1858, he summed up his modification of republicanism in three crisp sentences. As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy. Democracy, in other words, is the ideal of inclusive non-domination. We're still not in Hobbes land. It aspires to achieve the same sort of freedom that Republicans had cherished, namely security from domination, but democracy seeks such freedom for all. That's Lincoln's view. For a Democratic Republican, impressed by Livy's emphasis on religion and Montesquieu's on the spirit of the laws, a just legal order and a virtuous citizenry are interdependent. The laws neither make nor enforce themselves, but need help from citizens. This is Lincoln's view. The rule of law will have its desired effects only if citizens, not all of them, but very many of them, become sufficiently vigilant, courageous, just, prudent, and well-organized to promote the common good. Among the virtues to be cultivated are a fitting respect for law and a disposition to change laws at odds with liberty. Well, this was the topic that Lincoln took up in his address to the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield, Illinois, on 27 January in 1838. This is the first of Lincoln's speeches to be published after he delivered it. This is when he's a young guy. On this occasion, the rules of the Lyceum prohibited him from giving an overtly partisan speech, so he can't name the people he's criticizing. In particular, he can't name his law partner's opponent in a relevant election, Stephen Douglas. Stephen Douglas is the person he has in mind when he speaks in the speech of a new Caesar. Opportunistic men of talent and ambition, he says, are apt to take advantage of social unrest. and there was plenty of that in evidence. His first example is a wave of lynching in Mississippi that has left corpses, quote, literally dangling from the boughs of trees upon every roadside like Spanish moss. He's speaking in Springfield, Illinois. So he's Mississippi's somewhat distant. Now he refers to St. Louis. That's pretty close by. In St. Louis, a mob had kidnapped a mixed-race man from the police, chained him to a tree, and burned him to death. Lincoln was concerned about the failure of local authorities. Well, he was concerned about the murder of that man, of course. He was also concerned about the failure of local authorities to do something about that mob action. The mob had not been held accountable. He says, "The lawless in spirit are thus encouraged to become lawless in practice." Now, the judge who had presided over the grand jury in the St. Louis case was, believe it or not, named Luke E. Lawless, as Lincoln's audience would have known. And when making public the grand jury's decision not to indict anyone, Lawless accused the mob's victim, Francis McIntosh, of associating with abolitionists. Lawless then read aloud from a local anti-slavery newspaper and incited his audience to ransack the paper's offices. So if you go read the Lyceum address online, it's widely available, you'll see that that Lincoln refers to a printing press being destroyed and thrown into a river. Well, this is the incident he's talking about. The paper's editor, Elijah Lovejoy, by the way, a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, had taken flight across the river to Illinois, where he and his brother immediately began organizing a statewide anti-slavery society and ordered a new printing press, the other one having been thrown in the river. Another mob now arose and killed Lovejoy while he and his friends defended the warehouse in Alton to which the new press had been shipped. This was 3 months before Lincoln gave his address at the Lyceum in Springfield, and these are the signs of what he called mobocracy that he feared would prepare the American people to accept a new Caesar. Having ever regarded government as their deadliest bane, Lincoln argued, the lawless in spirit make a jubilee of the suspension of law's operations and pray for nothing so much as its total annihilation. By such means, the bulwark of liberty is torn down. Whenever this effect shall be produced among us, Lincoln said, depend on it, this government cannot last. By such things, the feelings of the best citizens will become more or less alienated from it, and thus it will be left without friends or with too few, and those too weak to make their friendship effectual. At such a time and under such circumstances, men of sufficient talent and ambition will not be wanting to seize the opportunity, strike the blow, and overturn that fair fabric which for the last half century has been the fondest hope of the lovers of freedom throughout the world. That's the one passage in the speech where you can hear the future eloquent Lincoln. The rest sounds like the juvenilia it is, but you can see where he's headed. The twin dangers of mob violence and an American Caesar, led Lincoln to propose an absolute obligation to obey the law in this country, in the U.S. In 1844, Emerson wrote quite differently. Every actual state is corrupt. Good men must not obey the laws too well, Emerson said. Thoreau would soon refuse to pay taxes on the ground that the money would be used to capture fugitive slaves. Lincoln's proposal, in contrast, admitted of no exceptions for unjust laws, such as the Constitution's compromise position on slavery. Lincoln agreed with Thoreau on the immorality of slavery, but not on civil disobedience. In Lincoln's view, the fabric of society was too weak to survive much disobedience under the current circumstances. The Constitution would eventually need to be amended, but the means to this end had to be legal. A democratic republic can become and remain a society of laws, in the full sense, according to Lincoln, only if it is also a society of relatively virtuous citizens. So what Lincoln proposes in this speech is what he calls a political religion, and that's why I'm including it in this series of lectures. What he meant by this was a deliberately cultivated piety for the laws on which an inclusive republic of free and equal citizens depends. Well, that's at least most of it. I think he also has in mind a deliberately cultivated piety for the heroes of the republic, on whose sacrifices also the republic depends. So he was not proposing a federally established religion. For the Constitution he wished to see honored included the First Amendment. The vehicles for cultivating political religion would need to be non-governmental institutions, so political but non-governmental religion, and those institutions would include journals, lyceums, anti-slavery societies, revival meetings, and the more progressive lodges, clubs, and churches. The churches, he assumes, would also be concerned, of course, with cultivating piety for God, conceived in one or another way. To become president and achieve what he hoped to achieve while serving as president, Lincoln had to hold together a diverse coalition of anti-slavery religious groups that included, very prominently, evangelicals. He met with evangelicals on a regular basis while in the White House, week after week. This was not easy to hold this diverse coalition together for someone unaffiliated with a church, like Lincoln, and with a very austere doctrine of God. Many of the groups in his coalition were as suspicious of one another as they were of Lincoln's personal religion. But Lincoln held the coalition together in roughly the same way that Clarkson had held his coalition together in Britain, by constant tending of relationships and by tolerating disagreement over religion's ultimate or supernatural end. Well, a quite different coalition took shape at mid-century. In 1847, shortly before Emerson lectured in Edinburgh, Englishman George Jacob Holyoake published a rebuttal of William Paley's Natural Theology, the book of that title. Holyoake wrote, quote, "If it is objected that this book pulls down religion and puts nothing up in its place, I answer, precisely so." The objection assumes, quote, in the face of reason, that religion is a benefit to the world. I deem it the sworn foe of human happiness. That's Holyoake. Writing in an issue of The Reasoner, late in 1851, Holyoake declared, quote, that the sum of all knowledge and duty is secular, and that it pertains to this world alone, unquote. A fortnight later, he coined the term secularism as the name for this claim. This is the first use I can find of this term in English. A letter appearing in the same magazine soon referred to secularism as a movement. Holyoake then took on the task of defining it, seeking an audience broader than the readership of Holyoake's magazine. His friends invited Reverend Rowan Grant to engage in a series of public discussions with him, and I won't go into the details of those discussions, except to mention that they were held in early 1853, and they were published under the title Christianity and Secularism. Reverend Grant had wanted the question being debated in the series of discussions to be Christianity and atheism. Holyoake didn't want atheism being the term. This is where we get the notion of secularism. Holyoake's book on Paley made clear that he took religion as such to be oppressive. In an 1855 work that Lord Gifford probably read, James Buchanan of New College, Edinburgh, classified secularism as a form of modern atheism. That's the way Buchanan views the movement. And for Holyoake, you don't have to be an atheist to want religion eliminated from politics and science. Holyoake's movement reached the height of its influence under the leadership of a more able organizer, Charles Bradlaugh. In the U.S., when traveling in the U.S. to raise funds, Bradlaugh found an ally in Robert Ingersoll. Ingersoll said that secularism, quote, embraces everything that is of any real interest or value to the human race. It is, and this is the interesting turn, it is the religion. So secularism is the religion that is to be used everywhere and at all times, but not a religion that is so dangerous that it must be kept out of politics. So this American defines secularism as a religion, whereas the coiner of the term contrasted religion and secularism. Secularism for Ingersoll is a religion based on reason. It is the religion needed to infuse politics with reason and virtue. Now, under the influence of Auguste Comte, of his call for a universal religion of humanity, Ingersoll wanted something to perform the mundane functions that republicanism had traditionally assigned to religion. The expressive function is to celebrate the values and articulate the outlook of a virtuous citizenry would share, thus providing society with solidarity or cohesion. The formative function is to inculcate politically beneficial virtues in the citizenry. Machiavelli and James Harrington are two Republicans earlier than this who had assumed that any self-sustaining republic would have to fulfill these functions somehow. But they thought that existing Christianity would need to be reformed to get the job done, and if reformed, could get the job done. Moses Mendelssohn made a Republican case for Judaism's capacity to join Christianity in fulfilling the formative function. This was part of his case for Jewish citizenship in Germany. Before adopting a solution more like Spinoza's, the young Hegel questioned whether Christianity could fulfill the functions of religion for a free people. The Hegel part of the story is much too complicated for me to tell here. Holyoke, Ingersoll, and Comte all gave a negative answer to that question. That is, they all held that Christianity could not fulfill the functions of public religion. When Emerson visited Martineau in 1848, remember at the end of the first lecture I said that she was undergoing a crisis of faith at that moment. Well, she was in the process of leaving behind the Unitarian ethical religion that had shaped the outlook of her ethnographic book, Society in America, from which that story about the double amputee slave came, but also the amazing passages that I read at the end of my first lecture. Emerson had long since abandoned Unitarianism. Martineau's conversations with Henry Atkinson in the late 1840s inclined her toward atheism. Escape from what she now called the Christian mythology was necessary, she now thought, for moving beyond theistic superstition. And at this point, she's thinking theism just is superstition. In Emerson's London lectures, after visiting revolutionary Paris, so remember, he gives his Edinburgh lectures, he then goes to Ambleside, visits with Martineau, has a disappointing conversation with the aged Wordsworth, then goes off to Paris to witness the revolution firsthand. Then he comes back to London, and one thing he says in his very interesting London lectures is that he prophesizes the advent of a new church. But he doesn't recommend an ersatz ritual system like Comte, and this language of a new church fairly soon drops out of Emerson's rhetoric. In an exchange with Atkinson, Martineau pronounced science and theology incompatible. In 1851, she ordered copies of Comte's writings in French. They arrived, and she immediately began translating them, and her translations of those became the first source of access to Comte's writing in English. Mill's The Utility of Religion, Durkheim's Elementary Forms of Religious Life, and Dewey's A Common Faith all belong to this general territory. They all theorize religion primarily as something needed to fulfill public functions. Durkheim, as we saw in Lecture 1, defined a religion as whatever fulfills those social functions, whether it is oriented toward a supernatural God or not, a conceptual move not far from Lincoln's. Dewey achieved a similar result by redefining divinity as worthy ideals made incarnate, an idea very close to the ending of Emerson's essay, Experience. The full story of all these conceptual complications would include Mazzini, Saint-Simon, and many others. Okay. Why would an admirer of abolitionism, like Lord Gifford, oppose secularism? And I began this series by letting you hear his opposition to secularism in his 1872 lecture on Emerson in Glasgow. When Lord Gifford rejected secularism, he surely had Holyoke's movement in mind. The objection was to a thorough separation of religion from politics, morality, and science. Holyoke intended the complete replacement of religion by something secular. He didn't make clear how he intended to achieve the objective of extricating religion from politics, or how to define the limits of toleration, or how to explain what should happen to people who cross the line, or nor does he say who gets to decide any of this. All of this is in common with people like Sam Harris and Dawkins. All of that stuff is left out. In all these respects, secularism differs from abolitionism. Secularism seeks to free politics and society from religion. If this objective were achieved, Lord Gifford's religion would be extinguished. If religion were merely privatized, it would still be deprived of the role it had played in abolitionism. Secularists intended to place people like Lord Gifford on the defensive. The new movement drew a sharper distinction between leaders and followers than abolitionism had. Secularism was a top-down movement led by an elite strongly associated with an emerging class of professionals. The threat to broad-based coalitional politics was immediate. Secularism's proposals rested on its claims about religion and reason. Religion should be separated from politics because it is essentially oppressive, but it's oppressive because it is rooted in irrationality, according to the secularists. Locke was right about rationality, according to Holyoke. You are fully rational only if your beliefs are perfectly proportioned to the available evidence. What Locke and Paley failed to see, according to Holyoke, was that their criterion of rationality rules out religious belief as such. Only by taking the standpoint of reason can one practice politics or science responsibly. The irrationality of religion results from underlying processes of cognitive distortion. Lord Gifford rejected secularism's practical proposals because he rejected its essentialist claim about religion. As someone familiar with Thomas Reed's criticisms of Locke, Lord Gifford doubted that the nature of rationality had been rationally settled, and this made the entire secularist program strike him as arbitrary. What he was thinking, and he doesn't elaborate this fully, but I think what he's thinking is that there's some self-referential inconsistency in the secularist position. It relies crucially on a criterion of rationality, which itself has not met the test of that criterion of rationality. If neither Locke's criterion of rationality nor Holyoke's application of it has yet been settled beyond a reasonable doubt, the question of how religion should be related to politics remained open. Perhaps there should be some public lectures on such themes. Lord Gifford charges secularism with unrealism also. He suspects that religion is here to stay. The realistic question, he thinks, isn't whether to permit religion to remain involved in politics, but rather which kind of religion to foster. When he praises Emerson for seeing this, Lord Gifford doesn't make clear what he thinks religion is, but he certainly holds that secularism is wrong about religion's essence. Holyoke argues the case for religion's oppressive and irrational nature mainly by pointing to examples, all of which make religion look bad. Lord Gifford agrees that religion is often oppressive. He criticizes Saint Bernard for failing to address church tyranny, and of course, we know that he criticizes the forms of religion committed to pro-slavery theology. But examples of oppressive religion, in his view, do not suffice to show that religion is essentially oppressive, any more than examples of kitsch, which are, of course, plentiful, suffice to show that art is essentially kitschy. Examples of bad religion are compatible with the reductive sort of explanation offered by Holyoake, but also with the Livian sort of explanation favored by Lord Gifford. A reductive explanation needs a plausible hypothesis linking the oppressive effects of religion with something that is both present in all examples of religion and demonstrably responsible for the oppressive effects. Secularists such as Marx, Lenin, Mao, Freud, Dennett, and Dawkins posit cognitively defective social and psychological processes to account for the bad effects. Yet so do the Livians, as we've seen. The difference is that the secularist theories are meant to apply across the board to religious people as such, rather than limiting the diagnosis to people demonstrably complicit in particular forms of oppression. The hard cases for the secularist are self-consciously religious opponents of oppression. It may be that we have some among us. Wilberforce certainly qualifies as religious in Holyoake's terms. There were many thousands like him in the struggle against slavery and many thousands more in the struggles against patriarchy, white supremacy, and imperialism. Each such person is presumptive evidence against secularist explanations of oppression. This does not prove that reductive theories of religion are hopeless, but it does show the height of the mountain they need to climb. It is hard to explain the emergence of egalitarian freedom movements in the modern period without acknowledging the influence of people like Sandiford, Clarkson, Walker, and Hayrick, all of whom acquired their commitments by means that Holyoake would deem irrational. There are more straightforwardly practical questions to be asked about the religiously motivated freedom fighters who remain on the scene. Is it prudent to alienate them? Is it wise to make sacrifice of their religious identities the price of joining the struggle against domination? Would it be just to greet the heirs of Clarkson, Hayrick, or Walker with a diagnosis or a firmly held nose? Their congregations are meeting places with resources. Their assembled members possess potential powers. Some of them appear to be exemplary citizens. The poor often have little else but such congregations to rely on. Shall we first discuss Locke with them, then Holyoake's diagnosis, and then dismantle their congregations before joining forces with them against oppression? Feminism, Christian socialism, labor republicanism, the civil rights movement, and Swaraj carried broad-based, religiously plural coalition building forward into the 20th century. Abolitionism supplied them with arguments and diagnostic tools, as well as models of bottom-up organizing and accountable leadership. The strategy was to build a broad coalitional base while narrowing the movement's critical focus precisely. If the abolitionists had opted for secularism, they would have done the opposite and failed. Choosing religion itself as the opponent condemns a movement to a narrow, hierarchically organized political base led by deracinated, low accountability professionals. How has that sort of politics been going? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We've had a marvelously rich and stimulating lecture. We have moved from discussions of Socratic and Ciceronian and Livian influences on critiques of pro-slavery belief. We have had Elizabeth Hayrick added to the historiography of abolitionism. We have had a deconstruction of Lincoln's call for a political religion. We have revisited the invention of the vocabulary of secularism and its definitions. And throughout all of this, Professor Stout has also engaged with the intellectual life of this city and with the intellectual formation of the founder of these lectures as well, Lord Gifford. I think we were also told that, I believe, President Trump is accurate twice a day like the stopped clock. And I believe that we were promised a reenactment of some Quaker street theater during the questions. And if that isn't an inducement to stay for the questions and answers, I don't know what is. So can I ask you all to join me once again in expressing our appreciation of Professor Stout for this truly stimulating lecture. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. I was intrigued by the quote from Robert Ingersoll, where you said that he accepted... Sorry, is this working? Yeah. He accepted that secularism was a religion to be used at all times. But then he said, if I got this right, but not so dangerous as to be kept out of politics. And I was interested in two things. One, why does he categorize it as a religion at all, when others obviously have a problem with that? And secondly, what's the danger that he has in mind?
Well, part of what I'm trying to bring out is that the term religion is wobbling all over the place in this period, but that the heritage of Cicero and Livy is still so accessible through the standard curriculum of the major schools that the idea that religion is an essentially public function and that there is a need for the functions of the expression of appropriate forms of piety, like behavior on the one hand, and for the formation, the deliberate formation of moral character on the other, that there need to be institutions and practices set up for this. One plausible use of the term religion, inheriting that tradition, is to take it to stand for whatever performs those functions. If you think those functions need to be filled, you need some word for them. And the strange thing is that some of the secularists are using the word religion in a purely negative way, where the semantic precedent is Lucretius, and others are re-signifying religion in a Ciceronian Livian sense and trying to disconnect it from those forms of religion they consider superstitious. So now the second part of your question is, what did Ingersoll think was dangerous about it? He's much less clear about that, but he thinks his preoccupation is irrationality. He's a Lockean on the question of what rational belief is. He thinks that people who believe in God, meaning by this a being worthy of worship,
who is also the creator of the universe, are making a vast mistake. That when they make that mistake, and a mistake founded in unreason, they are liable to make additional mistakes that are going to give rise to various forms of tyranny and oppression, not least of which assigning a role differentiation to priests who supposedly know more about the nature of God than others, and others who will follow them. So it's something like that. But the difficulty is that it's the hard examples that I tried to identify before. What is he going to do with people who, and he doesn't really deal with these cases at all adequately in his writings, as far as I can tell. What is he going to do with people who hold beliefs that he considers irrational, irrationally based, but are among the most exemplary opponents of oppression there have ever been? That's part of the difficulty. When he harkens back to the Enlightenment period, part of the unnoticed ground for embarrassment is that some of his own heroes, and I mentioned Hume and Voltaire, are on the wrong side on the issues pertaining to slavery. So the part of what I'm trying to do with my selection of examples is to trouble the standard history that takes abolitionism to be the result primarily of developments achieved by Enlightenment philosophy, primarily a development of Hobbes, Locke, Kant forms of liberal social contract theory, then applied to another area of human life. Don't think that's how the history goes, actually.
I'm wondering about Frederick Douglass on the distinction between true and false religion. And in particular, I think you said he makes the point in the autobiography that his critics ought not think that he's a critic of all religion, of the Christianity of Christ, but only of the Christianity of this land. And you said, I think you wouldn't question that claim of his, and yet he must be aware of the rhetorical effect of making that distinction, as opposed to declaring himself an enemy of religion as such. And what else there is to say there? Do you suspect there's
I wouldn't put myself forward as a Douglass expert, and I'd be interested to hear if others have more to say about the details of the biographical details that might settle the question of his sincerity. All I'm saying is that from his published writings, I do not see anything that would justify a charge of insincerity on the point. But look, I mean, he puts it in two different ways when he draws the distinction. One is to make reference to pro-slavery religion, and the other is the religion of the Christianity of this land. And what is he doing by using both of those terms? He's certainly putting pressure on his audience to demonstrate through their actions that they deserve his approbation, his religious as well as political and ethical approbation. That's part of his purpose, I take it. Now, when talking in that way, he is putting less pressure on them in a sense than Emerson is when giving a much broader critique of organized religion and its dangers, and I'll talk a great deal about that tomorrow. So far, no requests for guerrilla theater.
Thank you very much. I think it's probably quite safe for me maybe to go between Cicero's time and the Enlightenment period, the Magna Carta. There is, the Magna Carta, the tenets of it were imported into U.S. Politics and thinking. And the Magna Carta was instituted by rebellion, barons against King's John, and it was up, and looking at it, it was the grassroots upwards. I know it's silent on the issue of religion, but where, if any, has the Magna Carta created some sort of base from which a law could be set, which has progressed to what we call secularism and the rebellion against the divine right of the kings and the oppression of the kings, the freedom of the vassals and the rights to a free trial. Where in this does the Magna Carta feature, if any?
Well, in my very condensed version of this history, I have not emphasized the Magna Carta, but to go more fully into this, we'd have to return to the territory that Professor Torrance and I were in some previous exchanges and Q&As after other lectures. When you take into account the full complexity of the different legal and constitutional traditions represented in Scotland and England in the first instance, but then both of those traditions feeding the American case, you have an English tradition rooted in the Magna Carta and common law informing something very much like the notion of non-domination, freedom as security from domination that I've been talking about, and you have another articulation of it in somewhat different terms in Roman law, the Roman law distinction between citizen and the free man, citizen, and slave, and then I've been emphasizing the Roman roots more than the others, but the others are there. And part of what one wants to do when looking at the American struggle for independence is to just look at how many different sources are being called on when making the relevant arguments. When shorthand versions of the history are done, it's almost always Locke, almost by himself, who's highlighted as a source for the American founders. But one should not underestimate the extent to which older English traditions, Roman ones, and crucially, Milton played a role for these figures. Milton needs to be elevated in his historical influence on how notions of freedom and religion play out. It's one reason that I emphasized the Milton epigraph in Wilberforce.
Thank you, sir. As usual, very good. My question has to do with law and democracy. What would you say when the law, simile of oppression and institutions of oppression, seem to be so static and unchangeable? Take, for instance, the 13th Amendment of the U.S., which says that slavery is abolished. However, a person can be enslaved as a result of punishment, which has led basically to what I call mass black incarceration in the U.S. Du Bois made this argument that the police force, especially in the South, was developed so as to re-enslave blacks. And so today, again, when you look at it, you've got this, difficult to just explain that this whole police brutality on blacks, targeting of blacks. And again, you have Trump appealing in his rhetoric to race and the KKK and refusing to even condemn David Duke. So you have institutions and this and law that seem to just be so static to perpetuate this sense of exclusion in the democratic process.
Thank you, George. It seems to me that there's more than one thing going on in that question. So one has to do with the theme of static organizational institutional forms, static ideologies. I'm going to talk a bit about that tomorrow in relation to Emerson's concerns about what he calls ossification. In the later parts of your question, there seemed to be a rather different image emerging, which is something more like domination as a many-headed hydra. You cut off one head and another one springs out. The concern that domination is something like an omnipresent shape-shifting monster, and that our own institutions demonstrate its protean shape-shifting capacities. I'm going to talk about that in the last of the lectures on Thursday. I don't mean to give a non-answer now, but I want to signal to you that I'm interested in both of these topics. I think they are different topics, and I'm especially concerned with the second one, because I think it's the second one that has done more to tempt the young. And I, like Emerson, when I speak or write, I always have the young in mind as my primary audience, speaking to people primarily at the moment when they are deciding what to do with their lives. And many people who are that age right now are demoralized by the image of domination as a shape-shifting, omnipresent monster. And I don't know that I have a sufficiently effective way of addressing that concern, but it's one of my principal purposes to try to say something about it.
Do we have any further questions? Yes.
Hi, thank you, Jeff. So, in passing, you mentioned the idea of the when a subordinated group adopts the perspective of the oppressing group, the paternalistic group, and that's sort of a problem with the cui bono rationale. And you made an offhand remark when talking about the cui bono that about Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud, and sort of not needing to turn to those sorts of theories of suspicion. Could you expand just a bit on the issue of the subordinated group accepting the rationale of the oppressing group, and what sort of account do we need for that, and is there a role for theorists of suspicion to address that at greater length? Or
so again, I'm going to point you toward the next lecture. The theme of servility, slavishness, that's a central theme for next time, as advertised in the title. What I want to say there is that the tradition that I'm examining has mainly Genesis and Tacitus in mind when thinking about servility. And they give this theme, servility or slavishness, the effects of slavery on the consciousness of the one dominated. They give this extremely high importance as a matter of theoretical explanation. Now, the next thing I want to say is that the people I'm talking about are theorists of suspicion. And it is part of my purpose to show the extent to which they are. So another way in which I'm trying to undercut the standard ways of approaches to the study of religion is to recontextualize the emergence of the so-called masters of suspicion. So Nietzsche, Marx, Freud, and so on. By showing that they are making use of the very same forms of argument and explanation as their predecessors. If you want to understand what they are doing, you need to see how they are appropriating those forms of argument and explanation, and you need to see what they're doing to them. And part of what I want to suggest is that what they're doing to them does not always improve the arguments and the explanatory moves. So this will come in when I discuss Marx and Professor West in Lecture 6. I'm going to try to use that as an illustration to get at your point. That's not primarily on the issue of servility, but arguments that can already be found in Milton, I will suggest next time, but also in very preliminary form in Tacitus, show up again in Thoreau, in Hegel, Marx, Fanon, and so forth on the issue of servility.
First, I just want to say it's a blessing to be here to witness this marvelous lecture and look forward to the next two. And if I've already read the first three, and so just to have my dear friend and brother here is a moment of sublimity for me. But my question has to do with Shakespeare, that you've elevated Milton, and rightly so. I think of your Yale lecture where King Lear plays such an important role. I think of Jane Addams' famous essay of 1894 that was published much later, A Modern Lear. We know that Abraham Lincoln in many ways walked around with Shakespeare in his back pocket and the gospel, not the gospels in brief of Tolstoy, but the Bible in the other pocket. What was the impact of Shakespeare for this new trajectory that you're laying bare for us in all of the rich hybridity of the republicanism on the one hand, the religiosity, which is prophetic, on the other? What impact does the inimitable Shakespeare have in this tradition?
I wish I had a good answer to that question, Cornell. I'm not sure I do. That is, what I haven't been able to do is to thematize it in the way I can with Milton, where in addition to the poetic works, we have the political tracts and the religious ones to provide more explicit, prosaic statements of positions, arguments, and so on. But here's what I can say. The figures that I will be looking at in as the tradition moves into the 19th century and beyond, Emerson in particular, take Shakespeare with enormous seriousness. And it's no accident that Shakespeare was one of Emerson's principal lecture themes when he came to the British Isles in 1847-48. And I think the Shakespeare lecture was one of the lectures that he gave in Edinburgh. So we'd have to tease that out, we'd have to go back to Representative Men. But look, the reason I haven't gone there is that when he's talking about Shakespeare, he's not saying much about religion. What he thinks is that Shakespeare has more insight than anyone else into the dramatic aspects of interaction of character and circumstance in human life, and a richer sense of the complexity of human character than anyone who has put pen to paper. That's his view. And it's probably still right, isn't it? Maybe Chekhov, I have to say.
Okay, I think we've had an appropriate set of points to end upon, thanks to Professor West's comments. This has been an intellectually enriching session. More riches, I think, await us later in the week. Please do attend the last of the lectures, but meanwhile, can we thank Professor Stout once again? Thank you, sir.